Welcome to Cloud Native Startup, where we explore what it takes to build a company in the open source cloud native ecosystem. I'm Emily Omir, your host.
And today I'm talking with Omri Gazit. Thank you so much for joining me, Omri.
Thanks for having me, Emily.
Omri is the CEO and co-founder of Acerto. And I'm going to go ahead and let you tell us a little bit about Acerto and about yourself as well.
Sure. I'll give you the kind of the Cliff Notes version. I've been in software for 30 years now. I was a founding engineer at a company called Neon in the 90s. We call it that, but back then we didn't even use the word startup. I found myself right when Neon was about to go public, looking at what to do next with my career, and I ended up joining Microsoft right at the right time. It was just starting a project called .NET, so I was one of the first maybe dozen people on that, and ended up kind of transitioning from engineering to product and then general management, eventually leading the application server and SQL server and some of the Azure divisions, including something called the Azure Access Control Service, which actually leads us to Acerto eventually. And left Microsoft in 2011, kind of got a little bored and wanted to do my own startup. That one didn't do as well as the first one that went public and ended up finding myself. It happens. Found myself at HP, leading engineering and then product, and then just running the division that built the cloud native platform for HP. So OpenStack and Cloud Foundry and Docker and Kubernetes and all those things, which was great because at Microsoft, we did no open source when I was there. And I joined HP largely to be able to learn how to do open source. And then went to Puppet, was the CPO there, ran product and engineering. And finally, about 15 months ago now, 16 months ago, started Acerto with my co-founder, Gert Drapers. And we've always been developer people. And we got together in the summer of 2020, late summer 2020, and both of us wanted to do something new. And we were trying to look for what was still hard to do as a developer. And back almost 15 years before, we had both worked on what became Azure Active Directory. And the idea there was every application had to know who was logged in and what they could do. And when web apps were starting to get created, SaaS applications, B2B SaaS applications like Salesforce and Workday and ServiceNow, they all had to reinvent identity and access. And the short story is identity has been really transformed into something that you can do on the web now through a bunch of different standards like OAuth2 and OpenID Connect and SAML and JWT. But the access part, what you can do, hasn't really moved forward at all. And so we immediately found a really interesting problem and a problem that still hadn't been solved. And we were trying to put a cloud native spin on it. So that is the genesis story for Acerto.
That's awesome. In fact, so I was just working on an ebook for the new stack about zero trust. And one of the things that jumped out at me about Acerto too is that usually I would see people talking about authentication and authorization, like one thing, like not separating. In fact, Acerto might be the first place where I've seen anybody taking the authorization piece out and focusing just on it. So I was curious, what does that mean? Like, why doesn't anybody else do that? And how did you sort of zero in on this as like a place, like where's the pain? How does that manifest itself?
Yeah, we're singing from the same hymnal here because that is exactly the problem that Gert and I saw. You basically have, you start out building an application and all the tutorials that you get from companies that build identity providers as a service, like Auth0 and Okta and, all the rest, they basically kind of leave authorization as almost a small little implementation detail. They'll typically tell you, if you have an admin, then bake a claim into the access token that we, the identity provider, are going to mint for you and use that for authorization. And we were just super frustrated with that approach because it basically runs out of room. And we saw that time and time again with people that we talked to. So we did a bunch of interviews with CTOs and VPs of engineering, and they all said, authorization's the big problem. It's a big pain in our butt. It's not really a differentiating thing for us. And we find ourselves having to continue to pour a lot of time and effort and engineering time. And, there's just a ton of opportunity cost in that. And yet there's nothing that does this for us in a way that makes any sense. It's absolutely the case that the first challenge is really trying to disambiguate between authentication and authorization. And that's an education thing. And I think when we first started, we still found people who, like, the world basically was split into two. The people who didn't know the difference, and it was kind of an uphill battle to try to convince them of the difference. And then the people who did, because they had battle scars. And so those are the folks that we ended up going after as early adopters.
It's always so gratifying to hear someone like validating like something that I didn't really understand as I was working on this. Like, oh, maybe you didn't understand because you weren't getting a good answer. Because I was getting, I'd ask people like, oh, well, how do you disambiguate between authentication and authorization? They tell me what the difference is. And I was like, okay, so tell me more. And I get a lot of like sort of hand wavy answers. So I'm really glad I got to ask you the question.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just to take, you know, kind of like a very concrete example, every product that you use that, you know, B2B context or, you know, in a business context, if you have an organization and you have a few people that work in that organization and they naturally divide into different types of roles, you know, different types of permissions. And more importantly, some people have certain types of permissions over certain resources, but not other resources. And that is an impossible thing to do in an authentication system. You can't predict all of the things that a user will be able to have access to because you don't know them ahead of time. There may be a, for example, in a document management system, when you authenticate someone, you may not know that a document was just created, you know, in the last few minutes, and you can't really bake that into an authentication token. And so basically convincing people that authorization is something that you have to do on every application request is something that I think eventually will permeate around the entire industry. And fortunately, we do have a set of vendors that are trying to do what we're doing. And so on the one hand, we compete. On the other hand, we all share the same challenge of education, of educating developers and the people who make decisions on technology that these things are really different.
Let's go back to sort of the business focus. Tell me a little bit more, you know, when you were first chatting with your co-founder about starting a new company, how did the conversation go? I mean, it sounds like the starting point was, we want to start a company. What are we going to do? And how did the conversation go? And how did you end up with this idea?
We both knew each other from a few different journeys together. So we worked together at Microsoft and then at HP and then at Puppet. And one thing that was in common, you know, across our careers was that we were always passionate about and focused on problems that were focused on developers as an audience, or developers as an audience and problems that they had. And both of us had some grounding in the identity and access space, obviously, having worked on the Azure Access Control Service, and Gert having worked on System.Identity, what became Azure Active Directory in Microsoft. And I recall being at EIR at Costa Noah at the time, who is our lead investor, and we were searching for interesting problems. I had some initial ideas in the DevOps space, and I had a few conversations with other EIRs there, and we kept on gravitating towards the fact that access control and authorization was just broken, a broken experience for a lot of different audiences. So for developers, there's just kind of like an opportunity cost there. You have to build from scratch as opposed to try to buy something and saving your precious engineering resources for things that really matter, things that move the needle. And for the IT administrators, like the people who work for companies that basically have to onboard and administer these SaaS applications, their life is pretty miserable. They live in dozens, if not hundreds, of different consoles, basically, and they have to go manually assign roles and permissions to people, and misconfigurations are rampant, and it's just a, you know, soul-crushing experience. And then, you know, not to mention CISOs and auditors have a lot of pain here too. Finding the needle in the haystack, wondering who in the organization still has entitlements that they shouldn't. It's just a problem with a lot of different pain points and a lot of different audiences. And so we knew we had something here. And as we started diving deep into the problem and talking to prospects, basically, CTOs and VPs of engineering, we had a very strong reaction from folks that basically said, look, this is not something I am an expert in. I don't really need to become an expert in it. But right now, since I'm building it, I am. And if we had a solution that was, you know, of reasonable cost that we could basically substitute and use, it would be something that I would switch to in a heartbeat. So those things gave us a lot of confidence that we had hit on a problem that was, you know, an aspirin type of problem, not a vitamin type of problem, and that there was a market for it.
And how was this different from, I'm going to say, both your first startups, the one that you joined as a founding engineer, and then the one that you started back in 2011, I think you said?
Yeah.
How is this time around? Like, what are you doing different than you did the first time you did it yourself? Why don't we just start there, and I'll ask the next question later.
Yeah. So the first one, Neon, I just graduated from college. I was 20 years old, and I happened to just run into a person who was just about to found a company. And Peter said, hey, why don't you come work with me? And I thought that it was a really interesting opportunity to learn a lot. We didn't even use the term startup at the time, but I learned a ton about like what, you know, it meant to build software at the time. It was honestly pre-web, and we built a product that was connecting kind of the new world of Windows and client server applications and three-tier applications later on with, you know, enterprise data sources. And I learned a lot about what it meant to build an enterprise grade product. And then, you know, going to Microsoft was building the platform that was floating a lot of boats. And I was just really fascinated about being part of that journey and building the new platform for Microsoft that developers like me and Neon could basically take advantage of and build whole businesses around. So that one, I would say I was an engineer and along for the ride, learned a lot about all the different types of roles. I didn't just write code. I also wrote documentation and marketing materials and trained salespeople and went to give talks at conferences and did pre-sales and post-sales. And there's a lot of broad experiences that you get at a startup that has only a few people. And then with Built Steady, I had a consumer software itch that I wanted to scratch. And the biggest learning there, honestly, is me and my co-founder had a great time. I loved going back to writing code and being an engineer again. But, you know, we just didn't have any business building consumer software. We were really kind of developer and enterprise people. And so with Acerto, I knew that I wanted to focus on things that I really had some experience to contribute in.
That's excellent self-awareness. I personally feel the same. I don't understand anything consumer facing. It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah. At first you go, well, I am a consumer, so I have some empathy over the problem that I'm trying to address. But, you know, there's just like the go-to-market is just so completely different, I find. And yeah, it's experience matters, I would say. Experience is something that you want to take advantage of. And I do remember like talking to people early on, people who wanted to give me advice. And they said, what are you doing a consumer thing? Just go do a thing for developers and for enterprises at the intersection of those things. That's what you're good at. But of course, I had to learn the hard way.
Of course. So another question actually that I had is when like I go to the Acerto website, you'd say like it's cloud native authorization. And I'm actually curious, was authorization fixed pre-cloud native?
So back pre-cloud native, I would say, let's go all the way back to server software, you know, before SaaS. You basically had a component in the operating system. In Windows, it was called Active Directory. And on non-Windows systems, it was an LDAP style system, a directory. And the, you know, server software, let's call it SAP, would basically, you know, would find out who's logged in from the operating system and would typically kind of assign them a role based on the groups that were attached to them in the directory. And, you know, life was good. And you only had as a vendor, you know, you really only had these two things to integrate with, Active Directory or LDAP. And actually Active Directory had, you know, talk the LDAP protocol as well. But if you fast forward to the age of SaaS and cloud, there's no operating system to ask. And each one of your customers is going to run their own directory. And it's kind of hard to tell them, hey, go add all these groups and permissions to your Active Directory. And so this is, you know, one of those things that was easier to do pre-SaaS and pre-cloud native than it is now. And the login part, ironically, when I started first thinking about this, my boss, who is the president of this server and tools business at Microsoft, said, look, Active Directory, That's the linchpin workload for Windows. That's the source of stickiness. We got to figure out how to make single sign-on work in the cloud. And so that's where we started focusing. My initial foray here was an access control service, but we couldn't really build that until we had kind of the login, the authentication problem solved. And so as an industry, we ended up spending, 10 years, 15 years building out all these components. And now you have what I call the interoperable identity fabric in the world with all these specs, like I mentioned, and whole companies that were created like Okta and Auth0 that have basically delivered on this promise of single sign-on for the web. But authorization is something that, you still have every single vendor having to roll out their own.
Could you tell me actually a little bit more about your relationship with Open Policy Agent and how you're related to the project, how you use it, and how you've made that decision?
Yeah, so when we first started looking at what we wanted to do here, a little bit of background, Gert and I both worked on open source for the last 10 years, ever since leaving Microsoft. And so, we saw some of the evolution there. Linux was a really interesting thing, a lot like really the bazaar, right? But then in the, mid-2000s, early 2010s, there were really kind of single vendor open source ecosystems. Puppet was one of them. I worked at that vendor. And that kind of gave way to multi-vendor open source ecosystems, starting with OpenStack and Cloud Foundry and Kubernetes and Docker. And we found that multi-vendor open source ecosystems, when they're truly open, are just amazing because they float a lot of boats. Kubernetes is just a wonderful example of that. And so we looked around and we tried to figure out what the right building blocks were. What should we build? And we quickly convinced ourselves that building a new policy engine and defining a new language was going to be undifferentiated over time. In fact, if we wanted to solve this problem as an industry, we needed less options, not more options. And so we saw some people trying to invent new things, and we felt like where we could really add value was in the integration, was building a solution around all these things. So we use the OPA engine. We actually contribute to the OPA project as well. We found some really interesting opportunities to add value around that. So for example, we created an open source project called the Open Policy Registry. We created a CLI tool called a policy tool that is able to build OPA policies as Docker containers, Docker images, or what's called OCI images. So you can sign them with open source projects like SigStore, and you can basically build and tag and version these policies, OPA policies, just like you would Docker containers. And we think that opens, that creates a lot of opportunity for being able to bring that entire tool chain, the Docker ecosystem, to OPA policies. And so that's an example of where we saw some white space. A workflow that we wanted to make first class didn't really exist. And we could basically add value around all these ecosystems, kind of bringing them together. So OPA is one thing. And so we're users and we're also contributors to the project. There are other things in the world. There's a paper that Google published called the Zanzibar paper. This describes how they do ACL style access control for Google Docs. And there's some really good ideas there that we're borrowing. So, our focus really is to try to build a great integrated solution. And where we have components that make sense to, that could be useful in a wide variety of scenarios, we want to open source them, including our Edge authorizer. So our authorizer that runs at the Edge is an open source project. And so people can go use that.
And can you tell me a little bit more about how you decide if you're going to open source something or not? And why? What was your motivation actually for open sourcing, say, the Edge authorizer that you were mentioning?
It's a fantastic question. And I think most founders don't spend enough time thinking about it. So back in at the time that Microsoft was really antagonistic with open source, Microsoft would make the argument that if you as a customer were buying something that had an open source underpinning, you were taking more risk. You were taking IP risk and you were taking integration risk. And companies like Microsoft that built an end-to-end cohesive solution that was proprietary just helped you defray that risk. In 2022, the exact opposite is true. Open source represents a way of de-risking an investment by a would-be customer. So you know, a customer that looks at something that's based on open source, at the very least, they feel like perhaps they can operate their own if the vendor goes out of business or changes terms in a predatory kind of fashion. And even more so when there are alternatives to pick from. So I think for a developer style offering, there has to be some level of open source to, you know, kind of overcome that barrier of credibility. I think it's also the case that, you know, you asked specifically what we open source versus what we don't. We have a philosophy that is called open edge. And I credit Luke Kinney's, the founder of Puppet, for coining that term. And I think it makes a lot of sense. Puppet basically open sourced everything. And in retrospect, Luke would say, we should have open sourced the agent. The agent is basically a piece of software that an individual can run on their laptop, on their machine, on their server, on their VM, and get some value. But then the, you know, the server part of Puppet that coordinates a lot of agents, that is the brain. And that is where Puppet, in retrospect, should have extracted, should have basically made, you know, proprietary and extracted more value from. And Luke would say, Puppet was all open source, and basically the open source software was just too good on its own to be able to, you know, kind of build things that add value around it and be able to create a business, a long-term business around it. And I think those are sobering kinds of observations, right? So when we think about open edge, what it means is the authorizer that a customer would run in their data center, in their VPC, in their cloud, as a sidecar or as a microservice, that needs to be open source. And they can actually run it standalone, independently, and not connect it to our control plane. But our control plane is where we bring a lot of value. It can basically tell each of the authorizers what version of the policy to run. It can collect all of the decision logs that each of these authorizers produce and create a single consolidated log of all the decisions. You can do a lot of things that really is where commercial customers would derive a lot of value from. So we were actually very deliberate about where we felt like we wanted to open things and where we felt like these are things that add value for us and allow us to create a commercial business.
Yeah. The question of, is your open source project basically too good, is one that comes up a lot. I know it's a criticism that people have made of Docker, and it's real. I mean, I can think of other companies that are much less well known that I also wonder, is their open source project too good? So it's an excellent thing to think about. And I think more companies should be really strategic about that.
Yeah. And I advise companies, and I oftentimes, you know, that's the first thing I ask them is, how do you think you're going to add commercial value to the open source that you're building? And, you know, the answers tend to be fairly similar. And I think we now have, we have almost, you know, playbooks for this, right? So RBAC, which, you know, is a little self-serving because we build a company that does authorization. So we help you, you know, build RBAC easily into your offering. But that's a classic way that open source vendors or vendors that are building a commercial offering around an open source project will make money. And, you know, kind of stepping out a bit, it's really kind of like organization and team features, right? So as soon as you basically have a project that is shared by multiple people in an organization, you're now creating some value. Like, you basically don't have each one of these users have to create their own login and live in their own isolated environment. They can share artifacts, and that's super important. And as soon as they can share artifacts, you need to be able to have roles and permissions around them. And I think other levers that you pull, scalability is one of them. So how to scale, and more importantly also, how to scale the management. So it's easy when you have one or two or three of something, but if you have 1,000 or 2,000 of something, that really calls typically for a different experience around managing things at scale. So I think that's an excellent way to add value for customers that are actually getting a lot of value from your offering. So you're kind of scaling with their success or with their usage. And then the last thing I would say is the hosting model. So you find a lot of open source companies that basically provide either a single tenant or a multi-tenant hosting experience for the open source software. And that's great. And that kind of helps because they basically operate the control plane for that open source. And that means that their customers don't have to operate it on their own. And then you have the opposite, which is large customers, typically in regulated industries, want to run everything in their virtual private cloud, in their VPC, or their even their on-premises system. So offering self-hosted versions is also a great way of building value around an open source project.
Talking about something a little bit different, one thing that I noticed is different about your history than a lot of people that I talk to on this podcast is that you have a lot of experience, not just at very big companies, but that you weren't just an engineer. You were like leading product, for example. Usually the people I speak with, they don't come from those like very high level, like executive type jobs to start their own startup. I'm just curious, what different perspective does that give you compared to other founders or that you just don't think other founders have?
Yeah, it's a great question and one that you get asked a lot. I remember Microsoft felt like a warm bath. You know, I was very successful there and it was a great place to grow and learn. But at some point, you know, you kind of get to the point of diminishing returns and most of what you're learning is how to become a better executive. And the not so polite version of saying that is how to do politics better in a large organization. And I think that there is something that's profoundly unsatisfying about that. And I found myself really itching to go do something new and kind of jump in the deep end of the pool again. And I think, you know, you basically have pluses and minuses that come from that. The pluses is you know what success ought to look at like at scale. So you have to have the passion and the desire to do things yourself again. And some people think they do, but, you know, oftentimes they find that they've either forgotten how to do them or it feels like a step back. And so, you know, I would say doing a startup for the reason of I'm trying to find a shortcut to success or fame or fortune or whatever is, you know, kind of never really the best motivation. But really kind of being curious about a problem and an audience and really having a lot of passion for solving it is the necessary ingredient. And then you have to have the humility to go back and do things that, you know, you haven't done for 20 years and learn how to do them again because they've completely changed from how they've been done. But, you know, ultimately, you do have a lot of patterns and experience that you can kind of lean back on. And for me, it was product and general management and engineering. I still enjoy writing code, and that's why I found myself oscillating between basically being a developer and kind of living those problems so that I have enough intuition about them, but then also knowing that I can't scale a company that way. So actively trying to figure out how to empower other people to take on the roles that I needed or the hats that I needed to wear when we were two people. Now that we're 18 people, it's no longer appropriate for me to do a lot of the things that we did in the first year as an IC. And so, you know, kind of knowing that and having lived through that pattern before is super helpful in just kind of knowing when to let go.
When you're advising other founders, do you talk about things like this? And what are some of the things that come up when you have those conversations? I'm almost asking, what advice do you give to founders?
It depends, obviously, on the topic, but oftentimes, you know, we talk about organizational structure, and really there's no one size fits all to any of these things. You kind of have to be able to assess what the problems that you're trying to solve for are and what the trade-offs are in making any changes. And so one of the most common transitions that startups have to make is when do I actually bring executive management? Do I have product and engineering led by one person, or do I separate them out? You know, when do I actually go into different teams, different feature crews, or whatever you want to call them? Those are all very situational. And I would say the thing that I really enjoy doing is just brainstorming through the types of challenges that the founder or the CTO is actually seeing, and then trying to kind of work and like talk through the pros and cons of, you know, what's going on right now? Do we really need a change? Do we really need to bring this person kind of in? A lot of times, the best way to lose time, the best way to actually kind of lose focus is to bring the wrong person or the right person, but at the wrong time, right? So if an organization is not ready for that, you know, particular change, then it can very much backfire. So those are really kind of rich themes that I like to talk about.
Excellent. We're close to wrapping up, but before I let you go, I wanted to ask, what would you say is a mistake that you've made this time around with Acerto that you think, you know, now in retrospect was not something you should have done?
Wow, that's such an interesting question. I think, you know, one thing that we kind of jumped in with the assumption around is when we looked at who had the most pain around authorization, the larger the company, you know, Series C, Series D companies had definitely experienced the problem in a big way. And so our approach initially was to try to, you know, kind of land them as design partners. And what we found was that their urgency for addressing authorization was often lower than, you know, we initially estimated. They had it queued up behind other projects. And more importantly, the kind of degree of difficulty of kind of porting from their model to something that would allow them to scale, it would take time. It would probably take a good quarter to go do. And so I think that, you know, we initially, when we talked to smaller companies, they didn't have as much awareness of, say, the difference between authentication and authorization. And so we felt like they were probably less interested and interesting to work with. But I think in retrospect, that was a mistake because those green fields, you know, like are where there's the least amount of rebuilding to do. And so there's less friction in terms of actually working with people. Now, there is a trade-off, which is a lot of times they go, well, how hard could this be? You know, this is kind of like an admin bit in the user database. And so finding the right entry point, insertion point, and finding the right stage of business has been something that I think initially we got wrong and we're optimizing for right now.
Fabulous. Well, thank you so much for joining me. How can listeners connect with you or learn more about you or more about Acerto?
Yeah, so acerto.com is our website. At acerto_com is our Twitter. And I'm at OmriG, O-M-R-I-G. And we love to connect with folks, both on just general open source stuff. I always love talking about open source strategy. And if anybody needs help with authorization, we're definitely here to help.
Fabulous. Thank you so much again.
Thank you so much, Emily. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Cloud Native Startup. If you'd like to learn more about positioning, messaging, and go-to-market for open source and cloud native startups, head over to my blog, positioningopensource.com. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. I'm at Emily O'Meara, and you can feel free to reach out on Twitter or on my website and blog with questions or comments. If you enjoyed this episode, also please share and help more people discover this podcast. Thank you, and we hope to have you next week.